So let me quickly say a couple of words about today's speaker. So we are really very happy to have Clark Jin with us. He's currently a professor in the Department of Educational Psychology at Rutgers University. And he will give us his personal view and perspective on his academic trajectory as well in a minute. But let me briefly mention that he has a bachelor's of arts. He did that in psychology at the University of Kansas, and also a master's at the University of Kansas on curriculum and instruction. And then a PhD, his PhD degree is from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in educational psychology. He's serving the community in quite a range of areas, but maybe the most important thing, at least from my perspective, currently is with respect to these services, is that he's the chief editor or editor-in-chief of Educational Psychologist, and he has been in that function since 2009. So welcome, Clark. We're looking forward to a brief, whatever you like, a kind of introduction of your own perspective on your biography, academic biography, and then, of course, to your discussion of epistemic cognition.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you for everybody for being here. I'm really looking forward to this session and seeing what all and hearing what all of you have to say about things. In thinking about what led me to here, I think perhaps the thing that's to me most interesting about it is how accidental it all was. When I applied to PhD programs, I was living in Japan at the time, and that was in the pre-internet age, so it was actually quite difficult to get information about programs and schools, and I ended up deciding to do instructional design, instructional technology, and things of that sort. And so I applied to these programs, and when I was about to decide on a program, I got a call out of the absolute blue from Richard Anderson, who was director of Center for the Study of Reading at Illinois. And in conversations with him, he basically persuaded me to do something completely different than I had decided to do when I was applying. And so I went to work with him on small group reading lessons. And eventually, our group sort of switched directions while I was there, and we started the program of research that Dick and others, including myself, have continued to this day, the work on collaborative reasoning as a discussion format. And then another serendipitous event was that I hooked up in terms of work with Bill Brewer, and we started working together on really thinking about how philosophy of science issues could be applied to the psychology of learning and thinking and reasoning. So basically, my research now is really grounded in the work I did with those two wonderful mentors I had at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Working with both of them was pretty much 100% accidental. And so where I am now is largely a path of serendipity. So let me just say also, Frank, you had encouraged me to say something about my role in the learning sciences. I think I'm editor of Educational Psychologist. My platform, my proposal to be editor included a strong emphasis on building bridges to the learning sciences. And so I think that I'm a person, I guess you could say, without a strong identity, in the sense that I feel strong kinship with anybody who's interested in how people learn, think, and reason from whatever groups they come from. And I probably about as much as anybody around straddle both areas, with one foot in learning sciences and one foot in educational psychology. A lot of my thinking about epistemic cognition really is motivated by the kinds of critiques that learning scientists have been making about learning and reasoning over the years. And so I'll be talking about some of those today. not knowing exactly what people would be interested in, I decided to basically err on the side of having lots of different things, different directions we could talk about. So I've prepared more slides than I expect to get to. And also your introductions have given me some ideas of what we might, some of the things you're interested in. And so we'll talk about some of the issues and others we won't get to, but you're of course welcome to look at some of the other slides, some of which are kind of self-explanatory, and you could have a look at later if you'd like the things we don't get to. All right, so I think you all have access to the slides in Dropbox. So if everybody would open those, I will talk about a few, and then we'll have, the plan is really to talk about a few slides at a time, and then pause to discuss various things. So I am now looking at slide one, where I acknowledge lots of people I've worked with over the years, and unfortunately didn't have space to write down the names of the many, many people I've learned from, either from talking with them or reading their work. And then on slide two, you'll see the outline for today, or at least we will hit on some parts of this outline and others we probably won't get to, but here are some of the options for us to talk about today. I'm going to start, and because a number of you in your introductions actually queried, you know, the relationship of some of the terms, so I'm going to actually start by some of the terms. I think that one of the key things about the learning sciences is that it leads us to actually question what we've typically called epistemic. Another option is to look at an updated version of the framework presented in the paper that you read. I think it's from those who have read it and talked to us about it, it may be a little make a little more sense and be a little more coherent. Third, we will an option to talk about what is cognitive versus what is metacognitive about epistemic cognition. And then other options to discuss are some lines of research on epistemic cognition and psychology, and then really learning sciences critiques of those research. It's my understanding from talking to Franck yesterday that one of the goals of this is to also understand, you know, what is unique about the learning sciences in thinking about these issues. What do we learn about the learning sciences through the approach we take to these issues? And so I have quite a few things to say about that as well. So in the third slide, you see that there's an introduction to the first component, clarifying epistemic and cognition. And so a lot of my work in the last 10 years has sort of been engaged in battles about what epistemic means. So let's have a look. On the next slide, on slide five, you'll see a list of 12 statements. And so the question is, which of these statements would you view as making an epistemic claim? So this could be they're making an epistemic evaluation, an epistemic description, or an epistemic or articulating an epistemic goal. So some you may view as being epistemic, some as not articulating epistemic evaluations, descriptions, or goals. So what do you think about some of these statements? Which are epistemic, which are not? Franck, you had said that it would be very easy to set up some breakout groups. I thought might be fun to try that. What do you think about, is it easy to set that up right now?
I need 2 minutes.
We can go ahead and start talking about it. And then we'll see if there's if it may be worth discussing a little bit more in 2 minutes. How does so looking at the statements on slide five, which are epistemic, which are not, and why do you think so?
So we just made a quick guess based on the article, and we would go with 1, 6, 9, and probably also 11 out of various reasons for based again on the article.
So why do you think those are and others are not? For example, why not number 10?
Not number 10 because it's a fact that can be verified. It's not about how the...
So I think the thing about number 10 that's a little ambiguous to me is, and especially in light of the Rock Cycle paper that was sent out, is there is in the statement that because I read it on Wikipedia, there's sort of an implicit a statement about reliable sources of knowledge. So I don't think it's necessarily as clear cut that it's not epistemic.
Great. What are some other thoughts?
Yeah, I would build on the previous argument and say that on the other hand, it's quite on the side of unreliable, if I am not biased by the fact of it deriving from Wikipedia. But the way I got it from the article, it's clearly on the side of unreliable sources. So it's not into the epistemic cognition field that strictly.
So it's interesting because what you just said kind of contradicts something, because you said that it's not epistemic because it's an unreliable source. You are making a sourcing, a judgment about the source, and then evaluating the quality of the evidence based on the source, which is an aspect of epistemic cognition in the way I understand it.
Well, let's. So I'm going to come back to this. Let's look at a few other slides. So slide six. One of you in the LMU group also asked a question about the terms epistemological versus epistemic, and I have to tell you that I have a minority position on this particular issue. There's been a fair amount of consensus, it seems to me lately, that that epistemic refers to more workaday, everyday. Or even just professional practices, where epistemology is seen as referring to sort of philosophical discussions of these issues. I don't really buy that distinction because we don't really use that distinction in any other fields. For example, we use the term biological. I can say I have ideas about biological matters. That does not refer to the field of biology. That refers to, you know, organisms and systems within organisms. So I don't think that we use other terms like that in this strong way, that biological only refers to the science of biology and not to biological things. I also think that although there's a tendency for philosophers to use epistemic to refer to sort of people's thinking, I think you can also find lots of instances in their work where they use the word epistemological to sort of refer to cognitive processes as well. So I myself don't draw a strong distinction between epistemic and epistemological, but many in the field want to sort of reserve epistemological for what people are thinking about, sort of the field of philosophy, the field of epistemology. As you've noticed in your introductions, there's lots of terms: epistemic cognition, epistemic beliefs, personal epistemology, epistemic thinking. But all of these, what they have is epistemic. And so what is this? And common answers are that the epistemic is about knowledge. And almost every definition you read in an educational or psychological paper, it will center around that the epistemic is around what knowledge is, beliefs about knowledge and processes of knowing. The key term is knowledge. And if you look at philosophical work, you'll see that epistemologists offer definitions like that too. But I think, so here is again where a learning scientist's critique comes in. Let's not just look at how people briefly define themselves. Let's look at their actual practices. Let's see what epistemologists do, what philosophers of science do, to understand what the actual targets of their research is. And if you look at that, so on slide 7 I put a one of these word diagrams. And you see, I mean, this is just a small proportion of the kinds of things they talk about. And it's not just about knowledge. On slides 8 through 10, I'm not going to go through them all, but I've put some articulations by eminent epistemologists about what the subject of their field is. And so Alston says, epistemologists investigate the operation and conditions of our cognitive faculties. Perception, reasoning, belief formation, the products thereof, beliefs, arguments, theories, explanation, knowledge. That's a much more expansive idea of what epistemology embraces than just knowledge and how we get knowledge. Alvin Goldman, very eminent epistemologist, epistemology deals with the whole range of efforts to know and understand the world, including the unrefined workaday practices of the layman, as well as the refined, specialized methods of the scientist or scholar. The ways that minds do or should deal with the various topics that the mind can address, individually or in concert, comprise the province of epistemology. This is a very, very broad notion, and I have other interesting definitions on the next two slides. I'm not going to go into them, except for let me just point out that a number of them focus on inquiry, thinking about what good inquiry is as being central to the epistemological enterprise. And this is really interesting to me because when we were, the 2011 paper that you read, one of the critiques we got from a reviewer was a flat statement that inquiry is not epistemic. And, you know, so there, I think it's really the case that philosophers have had a much, much broader view of what their field of study is, what their domain is, than educational psychologists and other educators have done. And so I think that, so this is actually a very learning sciences critique of a field, because learning sciences emphasizes really bringing ideas from other disciplines to bear. And so this is, I think, what we have tried to do with philosophy. So if on slide 11, you see some epistemic aims other than knowledge. In addition to knowledge, there's it's traditionally been wisdom. Wisdom has traditionally been viewed as one of the chief aims of, or as an epistemic aims. You can treat models as an epistemic aim. And models are different, at least from traditional accounts of knowledge, because knowledge is viewed as something, you know, a knowledge claim can be viewed as true-false. A model isn't true-false. A model is evaluated not as true or false, but as resembling the world in various respects. And so here are some other aims that philosophers and psychologists have talked about. And so I think one of the important things is that, you know, if you want, that there are many different aims, and that the way we look at what is epistemic is that, so what do these all have in common? Well, we've argued recently that what these aims have in common, as shown on slide 12, is their representational nature. They're providing a particular take on how things are, and thus their depiction of the world as one way and not another. And this idea comes from a statement in a conversation made by Catherine Elgin, a philosopher at Harvard who was trying to, who really thinks it's important that we not just think of knowledge as the only aim, but was trying to articulate what it is that all these epistemic aims have in concert or in common. So I would say that epistemic cognition comprises networks of cognitions, and I want to emphasize complex networks of cognitions regarding epistemic aims, how to achieve them, and how to evaluate whether they've been achieved. Oh, now let me just say, we have a couple of questions to get to. Let me say one thing about how I'm using the word cognition. And on this one, I'm just stating a convention that we're using. Whereas I'm really arguing for an expanded view of what the epistemic embraces based on the definition we provided on the previous slide, and just a look at all of the things that philosophers examine as being part of epistemic. But in terms of what epistemic cognition is on slide 13, I think there's different ways to different ways to label things. And so just so you know that when we use the label, we're treating epistemic cognition as the umbrella term. Whereas some people want to use cognition and treat it as distinct from metacognition, we're just broadly using cognition to encompass everything. And you might then divide it into two levels, sort of a practical level where you're thinking about practical topics, and a meta-epistemic level where you're thinking about epistemic matters. So a statement about meta-epistemic might be a statement, I think knowledge is generally complex. The topic of your thought is directed at the target, the topic of knowledge. Whereas in practical cognition, you're thinking about vitamin C, or you're thinking about Angela Merkel. And so I would argue that the statement about Angela Merkel is epistemic, because people are making an epistemic judgment. They're making a claim that they believe to be a knowledge claim, and they're providing a justification. And I think that anytime people are making a claim and providing a justification, that's at the very least an instance of practical cognition. So let's see, questions maybe now that we could stop and ask people to elaborate on. David, would you like to jump in and elaborate on your?
So I was looking at number two, for example, where it says Julia is careful in her work as an accountant. It seems like that's a disposition, and based on your disposition, you'll have certain stances or approaches to solving knowledge problems, and so that would influence your epistemology. So it seems like that should be considered a part of one's epistemic cognition or epistemic frame.
I think that actually Sarit's question gives us a good way to think about that. Sarit, would you mind elaborating?
I think it's difficult to draw the line between what we count as cognition or knowledge building in the very wide sense and what would count as epistemic, because if we do view all knowledge claims as epistemic products, then every act of knowledge building or making a claim about Angela Merkel would count as epistemic. And I wonder whether that's a workable definition. It might be too wide, and maybe you're suggesting, if I understand what you're heading towards, is that epistemic claims involve some sort of a consideration of our knowledge of the epistemic characteristics or of the truth value or of our certainty regarding right knowledge.
Well, one thing you'll notice is that for the most part, I actually didn't put a claim in here without a justification. Because I wasn't sure I wanted to get into those waters. I participated in a small conference about a year ago, and Alvin Goldman was at the conference, and it was clear that some of the educators in the room, they viewed a statement such as "your socks are on the floor" as not making a knowledge claim, because it wasn't reflective, that you had to have reflection in order to actually have knowledge. And the philosophers were very strongly against that notion, because the idea is that almost all of our knowledge is this kind of knowledge claim, these kinds of, you know, everyday, or at least lots of our knowledge is these everyday knowledge claims, and we are justified in believing them. We're justified in believing our, you know, the ordinary outputs of our perceptual system. And so I think that, it's certainly an epistemic process that delivers that that claim. Whether it's epistemic or not, I think you're going to find lots of people in the field disagree about that. Does anybody else want to weigh in and have thoughts about that? Yeah. There's a philosophical angle on this issue. You may have seen the terms in epistemology, internalist and externalist. An internalist believes that that knowledge has to be justified by something internal, a reason that you give of some kind, or reasons that you give. It's my understanding that at least many internalists, they don't require that you actually give that reason every time. If I say, your socks are on the floor, I don't actually have to articulate or even think about a justification. If I would be able to produce a justification on being asked, then that would count as a sufficient, you know, then I could be still counted as having a knowledge claim. So in the same way, if I say Barack Obama is the president of the United States, even if I don't offer a justification, many internalists would say I still have knowledge about that because I could produce a justification if asked. But an externalist takes a very different view. An externalist doesn't require knowledge to be justified by some sort of internal reason. You have knowledge, according to an externalist, just in case your belief was produced by a reliable process. So therefore, a dog can have knowledge, because a dog's knowledge about things that she has seen is produced by a reliable mammalian perceptual system. And so therefore, for an externalist, a dog has knowledge. So for a philosopher, whether simple statements are epistemic or not become very complicated, because it depends on whether you're looking at it from an internalist or an externalist point of view. So I see in the chat that the idea that having knowledge doesn't seem to be epistemic, that what is epistemic is the processes you use to get the knowledge. I could certainly live with that. That's a definition I would be happy with myself. I don't know if I don't know if epistemologists would agree with it or not. But I would be happy to work with it. Well, let me move on. So anybody who would like to come back and weigh in on these issues never go away. They keep plaguing us at every turn, trying to figure out what's epistemic and what's not. So let me give you a little bit of an update on what we're currently thinking about how to organize epistemic cognition. And so our current framework, you can see on page 15, has three components. The first component is aims. Second component is ideals, and the third is reliable process. Aims are easy enough. They're the person's goals and the value he or she places on these goals. Ideals are the standards used to evaluate whether various epistemic ends have been achieved. And reliable processes we are treating as causal schemas specifying the processes by which knowledge and other epistemic products are reliably produced, and they may also include associated procedural knowledge for executing these processes. On the next slide, on 16, so I won't say anything more about aims, we've already talked about aims a little bit, but on the next slide, on 16, you can see some information about ideals. And the term comes from Stephen Toulmin, who discussed scientists' explanatory ideals that guide the development of their theories. Ideals are criteria or standards used to evaluate epistemic products. So you can have you can have ideals or standards for evaluating whether the methodology of a study or reading is good, because a study is an epistemic product. It's evidence. These ideals can also be used to set up a vision for what you're aiming for when you create an epistemic product. It gives you an idea of what the theories that you're trying to create are going to look like when you're done. So what can you evaluate? Theories, explanation, models, inquiry methods, institutional processes, and also evaluate the epistemic character of people. Are they honest, sincere, and so on? So if we look at the criteria that scientists use that evaluate theories, we see that they use criteria like how fruitful is the theory, how well does it fit the evidence, is there any evidence that contradicts it, and so on. In work that we've done with seventh graders, we found that seventh graders collectively, not individually, but collectively come up with pretty much the same set of criteria for good models that philosophers claim scientists have done. So I think that these criteria are really accessible to people. On slide 17, you can see some of our ideas about some different categories of ideals that are used to evaluate, and these are really ideals for evaluating models or theories or explanations. So you can look at their internal structure. You might say that a good model in science has or a good explanation has a causal mechanism. It needs to be sufficiently complex, needs to be internally consistent. You can look at connections to other knowledge, such as cohering with other explanations, looking at connections to empirical evidence. A good model explains a broad scope of evidence. It's not contradicted by significant evidence, successfully predicts new evidence. You can have criteria in the category of good communication. Clear presentation is actually, according to philosophers, an epistemic issue, because you have to have clear presentation in order to get the ideas spread broadly in the community. And the spread of ideas in a community is epistemic. And finally, I sort of also created a category for testimonial ideals, because as humans, most of our knowledge comes from other humans, and we need to have criteria for evaluating whether to trust what other humans tell us, such as they are honest, unbiased, competent, and so on. On page 18, we elaborate a little bit on the reliable processes aspect of our framework, the R component. So reliable processes include schemas that specify the reliable processes by which epistemic products are produced. Associated with this are procedures for actually carrying out these processes. These ideas are all grounded in the work of the philosopher Alvin Goldman. I heartily recommend that everybody read it. Generally quite accessible and interesting. And the core idea that there exist many different causal processes that can be used to try to produce true beliefs, and that these processes vary in reliability. Reliable process is one that produces a relatively high proportion of true beliefs, and an unreliable process produces a relatively low proportion of true beliefs. And of course, you can substitute beliefs for other epistemic aims, good models versus bad models. And so we think that epistemic cognition consists in large measure of a vast repertoire of these schemas that can be used to guide action and evaluation. And we also think that this is a huge opportunity area for research, because there's been relatively little research on these epistemic, these reliable processes and people's ideas about them. Okay, I see there's a question from UIC, which is, what is a true belief? And so I'm going to just evade that question by saying you can replace true belief with whatever epistemic end you think is achievable. So if you want to say we can't possibly know what a true belief is, so we're going to instead just go for well-justified beliefs, then you can substitute justified beliefs for true beliefs. On slide 19, we provide some examples. Now, keep in mind, you know, when philosophers look at this, they want to identify really reliable processes and unreliable processes. And of course, as psychologists, we do too. But as epistemic cognition researchers, we're equally interested in what people think are reliable processes, either explicitly or tacitly. So we're not bound to look only at truly reliable processes or processes. It's just as interesting to look at what people think are reliable processes. So one of the things we know from the eyewitness testimony literature is that most people have faulty ideas about how reliable their observation and memory is when it comes to eyewitness testimony. And so this is actually really significant because it leads to improper convictions of people who are innocent, because people overtrust the products of observation and memory when it comes to eyewitnesses. And so this is a case where people have faulty beliefs about how they see, you know, how well they remember what they see, and that these faulty beliefs have real consequences. Some of the processes we talk about on page 19, there's masked observation, for example. The idea of course, implementing masked observation procedures when gathering data in a psychological study is a better way of looking at this. And so I see a question. The question from Weitzman, that's a great question. So let me set that aside for just a moment and I'll come back to that. So there's the active procedural use, which is to actually take those ideas about masked observation and design an experiment that employs masked observation and doing it properly. But you can also use this schema in an evaluative way. When reading a psychology journal article, you check whether masked procedures are used and you reduce your credibility that you give to the article if you find that masked observation was not used. And you can also use these schemas in a meta-epistemic way. You can actually articulate what you think. You can say what masked observation is and why it's important. That's a very a meta-epistemic reflexive use. Evidence gathering processes, same thing. You can use any of these schemas. You can use actively, you can use them evaluatively, or you can reflect on them. So a causal schema for developing knowledge could be to seek out multiple perspectives on a topic such as global warming when reaching a decision. An evaluative use, as an example, if you think that it's good to seek out multiple perspectives during evidence gathering, then if you read a meta-analysis on the effects of rewards on behavior that examined only research in behaviorism-friendly journals, you might conclude that that meta-analysis is not reliable. Argumentation processes. Your schema for argumentation processes may say that argumentation is a good way to get knowledge collaboratively. In order for it to work, you have to have members with diverse backgrounds and that encourage full vetting of ideas so that you can see that if you use this schema actively, then you would set up if you're trying to find something out, you'll set up a group that includes diverse perspectives. If you're using this idea evaluatively, and you see that a national commission evaluating a food additive only included one side of the issue in their commission panel, then you will likely distrust the results of that commission. And you can then, if you look at slide 20, and then I'll come back to some of your questions. Oh, so the question about masked observation, that's blind observation when the observer doesn't know which condition what being observed was in. So 20, again, a little bit more on the schemas. So an example, observation and memory. The schema, you may think, explicitly or tacitly, that visual observation is highly accurate and that your memory for observations is good. We know that eyewitnesses tend to think this, and they're often wrong. But notice there's also conditions on these schemas. We argue that people don't think that these schemas apply across the board, that people are aware of conditions under which these processes are reliable and conditions under which they're not reliable. So for example, observation, accurate visual observation requires enough light and you have to be close enough to actually see. Evidence gathering processes, you have, when gathering evidence on an issue, one should seek out evidence on multiple sides of a question. But for that to work, there are conditions that must be applied. You have to have access to enough information and sufficient time to process it. As another example, consider the polling processes that political scientists and polling agencies like Gallup use. Polling opinion with random samples of the population is a good way to determine what public opinion on an issue is. Now, notice that when we're looking at psychology, we're looking at what people think, not whether they're what they think is right necessarily. We have some reason to think that many people think that there's a condition on polling, that you have to have very, very, very large samples in order for those polls to be real, to be trustworthy. And of course, statistically, we know that that's actually a mistaken or a partly mistaken condition, that you need representative samples. But if your samples are representative, you can actually get very good results with very large samples. And so this is an instance where people's ideas are often wrong about the schemas they apply to understanding reliable processes. And finally, we've talked about argumentation. Argumentation is a good process for achieving good theories in science. But there are conditions on this. Presumably effective argumentation requires a reasonable degree of cognitive diversity in the group, and you have to be willing to consider others' ideas. And if those conditions aren't in place, argumentation won't produce reliable knowledge. So this is a framework that basically, I think, differs from other frameworks, and I think it's very consistent with what philosophers are looking at right now, that says that in order to make judgments about things, epistemic judgments, we have to apply a really, really large repertoire of causal processes, of our understanding of the causal processes that work and don't work to produce knowledge, to produce good theories, to produce good evidence. And that much of our work on epistemic cognition probably ought to be directed at this. Sarit, who has joined us, has talked about many of these ideas in terms of the strategies that people apply. So I think that Sarit's strategies are very similar to what we're talking about as sort of an active use of causal processes. So this is a good place, I think, to pause for questions, discussions, comments. There is a question that was up just above about is reliable process a part of ideals? So let's put that as one question we can consider, and I'd also like to open it to see what else people have to say. And our any thoughts or questions at this point? Well, I'll just say, so please join the queue, and I'll pause to encourage you to, or I'll pause. So we have the question that was in the chat about, isn't reliable processes a part of ideals? And I think the answer to that question is yes, for the following reason. If you believe that, as Alvin Goldman certainly does, that knowledge is, in fact, to be analyzed as the product of a reliable process, then that becomes a criterion for deciding what a reliable, for deciding whether you have knowledge or not. So it's certainly impossible to include produced by a reliable process as one of the criteria for knowledge claims. So in other words, yes, I think that reliable processes could also be viewed as ideals. So here's the question. Can I describe something that I don't consider epistemic cognition? So let's go back to slide 5 that we considered a little while ago. So if you can go back and find slide. So I think there are some here that are not epistemic. So I would say that number 3 is not epistemic. I want to get the highest score in the class, I would argue, is not epistemic. That's an achievement goal. That's a goal to do better than other people. There's no indication there that the goal is to learn something or to acquire knowledge or to figure out what the best theory is. I enjoy a challenge, I think, is also not epistemic. First of all, there's many kinds of challenges, not only epistemic challenges. So that by itself, I would say, is not epistemic. And if there are those who would like to argue, please jump in and we can discuss these. I'm not seeing. To complete assignments as soon as possible, share the work with peers. I think there's an argument to be made that that's not epistemic because the goal is to finish, to complete it, not to actually, I mean, the completion doesn't necessarily say to complete accurately. And the goal seems to be a matter of speed, not a matter of actually acquiring knowledge.
Hi, so I might be projecting a little bit too much into the AIR framework here, but it seems to me like the aims and value component in a way addresses, you know, questions of situational variation. Why does, let's say, epistemic cognition take one form in one context but not in another? And the ideals seems more dispositional, trait-like. And in looking at the reliable processes here, I appreciate, obviously, that you said that the possible schema for any one of these might be incorrect. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, in this framework, how you see these schema arising and to what extent are they themselves subject to revision over time. And, you know, would we consider this to be, let's say, the component of a person's epistemic cognition that develops or that is learned?
Wow, that's a great question. I wish I had a great answer for it. To my knowledge, there hasn't been a lot of work on these issues. If anybody knows of work on these issues, would you please jump in and tell us about it? There's the one area where there's been a lot of work, and including developmental work, would be on the control of variable strategies and certain other basic reasoning strategies in science class. And so we have some idea there, and I think we also see that these strategies, these understanding of how you go about designing in a controlled experiment, how you interpret experiments that are and aren't controlled, there is development there. And it's fairly slow. And related to your point, it's clearly domain specific too, because in order to know whether something has been controlled, I have to have a pretty good domain theory of the area. I have to know what variables need to be controlled in order to even guess whether the right kinds of things are being controlled or not. So I think there's development in some general knowledge, and we've seen that in the literature. But I think there's not as many other topics that we have So I lost track of my thought there because I started reading other questions that were appearing in the chat. I think that there's not as much research on other topics. I'm not sure. I've seen work on the development of the faulty beliefs about eyewitness testimony, although we have a lot of research that people do have faulty beliefs about eyewitness testimony. Philosophers sort of speculate that what's going on here is that you're doing kind of a covariation analysis of what works and what doesn't. So basically I would say there's really interesting and important developmental work to be done here, and I'm not, I think, and that's just one of the huge needs, I think, in the field of epistemic cognition, is to take a look at how these various schemas develop. So the question isn't knowing that you're the type of person that enjoys a challenge epistemic. Boy, I have to say, I really feel uncomfortable being in the position of sort of stating an opinion which might be viewed as somewhat authoritative, because I definitely chose a number of these because they are problematic. A number of the examples on slide 5, I think, are problematic. I'm also inclined, as you might have guessed, and in contrast to some of my peers in the scholarly community, I'm inclined to be a little more expansive than other people might be. So I'm going to tend to be receptive to arguments that there's a way of looking at enjoying a challenge that makes it epistemic. So for example, now if we were to specify I enjoy the challenge, if we were to say I enjoy the challenge of figuring out what the best model is, then I think we're clearly epistemic, because then that enjoyment would be an emotion, a kind of epistemic emotion that is part of the process of achieving an epistemic end. But I would be inclined to say that challenge by itself is too broad a word. It might be the challenge of winning a wrestling match. It might be the challenge of winning a race. So it might be the challenge of cooking dinner well, and it becomes a little more murky even to me whether those are epistemic or not, even though I tend to take an expansive view. So the question slide. I was warned the cognitive load of doing this is high, and I have to say it definitely is high. That's one of the things I was, when I talked with people at AERA about their experiences doing webinar, they said there's a real cognitive load issue here. So 3, 5, and 8, I said, yes, I agree those are not epistemic, because they look to me to be, in two cases, to be after non-epistemic goals. In the case of 3 and 8, in the case of 5, some challenges are epistemic, some challenges are not. I just think it needs to be defined more clearly to be unequivocally epistemic. Now, to me, it's absolutely clearly epistemic, but I must say that it's also clear that some folks in the field have not thought so, and I don't know whether any of our work has persuaded them that it is or not. Philosophers certainly view inquiry and any reflections and on what good inquiry is as being epistemic. I don't think there's any.
Hi, I would have a question on the AIR framework, because I just imagined I'm a graduate student, well actually I am, and I'm doing a study, and one of my aims could be to do a reliable measure. But this could also be an ideal or a reliable process. So I'm not sure where you would put a reliable measure in that framework, because all three categories for me seem to overlap quite a lot in different situations.
Yes, I think there is overlap. And I actually view that as a strength rather than a weakness, because I think the topic of study overlaps in that way. So, for example, if I think that designing a study with careful controls is a good way to achieve psychological knowledge, then that also becomes one of my ideals, and at the same time, it will become one of my aims. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to become one of my aims. So that's an important point, I think. I could believe that the way to acquire knowledge about a topic is to carefully research multiple sides of the question and to gather data from multiple perspectives. But I might decide it's not worth doing that. So I know that that's the way to achieve knowledge, but it's effortful, and I don't want to spend that much time achieving knowledge. Therefore, I think that you may or may not choose to adopt an aim that corresponds to a process that you believe to be reliable, because you may not want to exert the effort that it takes to engage in that process. But if you do, then that process will help you define your aim. Your aim will be to engage, at least a sub-goal will be to engage in that process to achieve the higher goal of knowledge or other any other epistemic end you want to.
So thanks for your clarification. And we have another question here.
Thanks for the clarification as well. But this raises another question for me. Is it necessary that all three, the aims, like the ideas you follow and the epistemic process you follow, have to be in an epistemic way? Or is it when, for example, someone wants to win a challenge and by accident creates a good model and he did never have an epistemic aim, would you consider this being an epistemic process still or not?
Is it possible for you to give an example? Can you think of an example?
For example, if I go on the street and I want to design a joke with a friend and I tell him something really aiming to have a good joke, and during telling the joke I develop a very good model that is like the state-of-the-art model for a scientific psychological construct for years, but it was never my aim to design a good psychological model. So my question would be if you would consider this still an epistemic process or epistemic cognition that I did.
Perhaps may I jump in here? Also, there are many discoveries made by accident, for example, the X-ray by the Curies, for example. Would that be epistemic? It's the same question, I guess.
So I have two parts. My thoughts about that are in two parts. The first part is, suppose it's the case that for a person or a subgroup of people, that when they tell jokes on the street, they frequently come up with really good theoretical ideas. I would say that would be a reliable process for, now keep in mind that generating good ideas even before they're tested, that's also an epistemic process, because certainly part of the process of science is to generate ideas that are worth testing. And so if you've got a reliable process for generating ideas that are worth testing, it seems to me that at least for that person ought to be out in the streets telling jokes quite a bit, because that's a reliable process for that person to achieve knowledge. Now there's another part. There is a truly accidental part, and by my understanding, and there are philosophers who have written exactly this, that the discovery that knowledge can be accidental has helped fuel a real proliferation of new theories and processes over the last 60 years. And the discovery was that the old idea of true justified beliefs doesn't work, because sometimes you can have a true justified belief by accident. And the last 60 years have seen many, many clever illustrations of this, but one of the easiest is Bertrand Russell's illustration, and that is that you get out of the train, you look up at the clock on the train station, it says 2 o'clock. So you said, okay, it's 2 o'clock. So you now have a belief, it's justified. You have looked at a clock on the station, which says 2, so you have a good justification, and it happens to be true. It is, in fact, 2 o'clock right now. But here's what you didn't know. That clock is stopped. That clock on the clock tower hasn't worked for the last 20 years. And it's always set at 2 o'clock. Now, you have a true belief, and it's justified because it is justifiable to believe the product of a clock tower you see at a train station. But in this case, it was incorrect. And so this has created a problem of essentially it's an accidental belief that has created a lot of problems, but it's also, according to my understanding, really been the source of a lot of the new theories we have as a way to try to deal with this problem. So a lot of the new, there are many new theories such as the virtue epistemologies that I wrote about in the chapter, such as reliabilism. It would seem to me that one of the motivations for that is to try to come up with better philosophical theories that can account for these kinds of phenomena. So that would be my answer to that question. If it's truly reliable, then a process is more likely to yield desirable epistemic outcomes than not, then yes, no matter how odd it is, it really is a reliable process if it can be empirically shown to reliably produce these outcomes. I think that one of the goals, perhaps we could, so I am going to skip ahead a little bit now to slide 26. So I want to just show you some, I'm curious what you think. So here are some, and of course there's a variety of measures that have been developed.
Yes, we lost our speaker. Hope he is back soon.
Okay, I crashed there for a minute, but I think I'm back. Can you hear me?
Yes, was very good.
So I see there's a question about, is epistemic cognition subjective? And we consider it true if it's justified. So one of my interests, but not an interest I've written about, is to think about what are the goals of instruction, and then we have to think of how we want people to think. But in other cases, I think that our research, we just want to see whatever it is that people are doing epistemically, whether it's right or wrong, whether it's if people are coming to beliefs that they think are justified and we don't, as researchers. In our role of psychologists, we just want to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. And it's a separate evaluation whether that's right or not. So Sarit, those of you looking at chat, says that maybe epistemic processes are sometimes tacit and sometimes intentional unconscious, but instruction, we target the explicit or deliberate. And I would be inclined to agree with this, but the caution might be that sometimes we might want certain epistemic processes to become automatic, in which case they would then become tacit. So I'm a little reluctant. Certainly, I would think that the research that I do with Rabit Duncan on reasoning in science classes has a strong focus on looking at making some of those epistemic practices explicit to them. I'll pause a minute in case anybody else has any questions they'd like to ask. And if not, then on pages, on slides 28, you see some sample items that have been developed by various researchers, some in educational psychology or in learning, some who might see themselves as learning scientists, some who see themselves as science educators. There are some typical items there. And then on the on slide 20, on 30, here you see an item that was used in a study by Kuhn, Cheney, and Weinstock. Robin believes one book's explanation of how the brain works. Chris believes another book's explanation of how the brain works. Can only one of their views be right, or could both have some rightness? And then you circle one of the answers. In case you think both could be right, you circle one of those answers. The idea there is that you can use results from a questionnaire like this to determine whether students are evaluativists. In other words, they think that some answers are better than others. whether they think that they're just objectivists, they just think there's one right answer to things, or if they're multiplists, they think there's multiple right answers and you cannot say that one is better than the other. On page 31, you see one of the questions that was used in a very influential line of research by King and Kitchener in their reflective judgment interview. There have been frequent reports about the relationship between chemicals that are added to foods and the safety of these foods. Some studies indicate that such chemicals can cause cancer, making the foods unsafe to eat. Other studies, however, show that chemical additives are not harmful and actually make the foods containing them more safe to eat. So, and then they ask, these are done in interviews, they ask students questions like, or the interviewees questions such as, what do you think about these statements, and so on. Now here, some of you, several of you have been interested in situative approaches. So, the first, so if we look now, so these are some typical items, the items I've shown on these three slides, some typical items that are used in epistemic cognition research by educational and developmental psychologists. And we can look at a critique of this, some critiques of this kind of research. So one critique can be made, as shown on slide 34, basis on the scope. So these kinds of questions, most of them don't seem to deal with reliable processes, for example, which we have argued philosophically is really an important part of epistemic cognition. Now, I think there's a learning sciences kind of basis for this critique, and that is that learning scientists value interdisciplinary approaches, and that strongly warrants bringing philosophy strongly to bear to think about these questions. And I think that learning scientists often are sympathetic to the idea that cognitive and social phenomena are going to be complex. And certainly expanding the scope of epistemic cognition involves more complexity. But we can also look, a second critique, and this is more of a critique that beliefs, stances, etc. are less general and more situated than has often been assumed. So if we look at slide 36, let's look at that same food additive questions again on slide 36. So let's suppose that on the food additives question, a student, an interviewee says that, both sides are right, and you can't really say that one is more right than the other. They're each entitled to their own opinion. So the question is, what does this show? And it's typically, I think, taken to be that this is shown that students adopt a stance of being a relativist. But on slide 37, we argue that it shows at most that a respondent is a multiplist or a relativist under a particular condition. So let's consider some other conditions. And these are all, you know, examples that come from reflections on philosophy of science and so on. So let's consider the lead example on page 38. Historically, many people believed that lead dishes were healthy to use. Now, all scientists and all governments agree that lead is harmful to human health and that lead dishes should not be used for eating or drinking. Now, it seems to me that a student who says that, well, you know, both sides are right on the food additives problem are probably much less likely to say that on this problem. They're much less likely to say that, well, you know, it's perfectly legitimate to think that lead is not harmful. Or the mercury problem. A group of villagers think that eating lots of bluefin tuna is good for you and is in fact essential to health, and we can list a large list of health and science organizations that tell us that bluefin tuna have high mercury content, that mercury is damaging to the brain, and so on. So again, this is a different situation. Is that interviewee who was a multiplist on the food additive question also going to say, well, you know, everybody is right. It all depends on their own opinion. I think when you have situations in which you don't have equal evidence on both sides, you don't have a sense where the experts are equally divided, you're going to get different responses. And so the idea is that we're going to get very different responses depending on the situation. Why don't you skip ahead a couple to two slides ahead to slide 40. So here are a couple of other examples. Sue and Raj are at a restaurant. They agree to give it exactly 15% tip on their bill of $73.15, but they come up with different totals. So what's going on here? So would a multiplist say, well, they're both right? I seriously doubt it. I think they're going to recompute and see which answer is actually right. And finally, and these last two examples on this slide are examples given by philosophers. So Clark and Warren are looking out the window at an object lying on the quad outside about 120 feet away. Clark believes the object is a dead crow, Warren is a baseball cap. So we could, shall we take a multiplist view that both opinions are right? It's a crow and it's a baseball cap. They're both entitled to their own opinion. No, we can, if we care enough about it, we'll just go out and have a closer look. And we'll see. So I think this suggests that we need to be really careful when we're designing items, because we can skew our results by our items are always going to involve a particular situation. And if we overgeneralize, that can be dangerous. This is a line of arguments, some of which are based on a book shown on slide 41, a book called Disagreement, edited by the philosophers Richard Feldman and Ted Warfield. And different conditions under which disagreement may occur. And so I think that I'm going to not talk more about that issue, because I think these examples make it clear. There are some other slides you can read more about this if you like. But I think that there's, you can see that people are likely to give different responses in different conditions. And what we ought to be doing, I think, in the field, is we ought to be looking at the different, rather than trying to come up with general stances that students take, or it would be very productive to look at the conditions under which they take different stances. The food additive problems is a very particular condition where there seems to be equal evidence on both sides, scientists seem roughly to be equally divided, and people will give different responses in situations that are different from that, I think. I think it would appear that we're just about out of time, so I would certainly, this might be a good place if anybody would like to raise any questions at this point. Frank, would this be a good point to sort of wrap up by discussing sort of what the learning sciences perspective on all this is?
Yes, of course, why not? So if there are no other questions left with respect to the disagreement and the other examples, then I think we should go on. And I think you already mentioned the aspect of so how your framework is related to the learning sciences, and also how a typical educational psychology or developmental psychology tools or instruments are somehow or can be critiqued from a learning sciences perspective. But maybe you could also the others can think about how can we relate epistemic cognition to the learning sciences perspective. So that would be one question. Why is that so important to be considered in the learning sciences more closely? I think you gave a couple of answers, but maybe you want to comment on this even a bit more, Clark, and maybe also the others. And my second question that I also ask all presenters is, what would be your recommendation? I think we had quite some perspectives today coming from philosophy, from different areas in philosophy as well. And what would be your recommendation for PhD students in the field of the learning sciences? Is it so how much philosophy is good for them, or to what extent should they really be open for philosophical perspectives and theoretical models when they do their PhD questions related to epistemic cognition, epistemic emotion, scientific reasoning, argumentation?
Well, Sarit would be a great person, and I'm sure there's others in the audience who would be great folks to weigh in on this. So let me give you my personal perspective. I would agree with a comment that Sarit made earlier, that I think thinking about epistemic cognition in some of the categories that philosophers suggest, I think it gives us a leverage into instruction. So whereas it's not exactly clear how you, it's rather vague to say we want to improve students' justification. But if you start to look at justification in terms of evaluating whether people have followed reliable processes, now you start to see some very instructable schemas, such as the control of variable strategies that are actually quite specific that can be tackled. When you think about criteria in the project that I'm working on with Ravit Duncan, we are really looking at how we can encourage students to be explicit and thoughtful and reflective about the criteria they use to evaluate evidence, the ideals they use to evaluate evidence, the ideals they use to evaluate models. And we think we have some evidence that's coming out that seems to indicate that that's a productive thing to do. So I think that one of the uses, and the article by Leslie Herenkohl, I think also at least is suggestive, that getting students to think explicitly about some of these things, the virtues and the vices, the different reliable processes they can use to develop good explanations, that is likely to be productive. And this, I think, gives us a lens on how we could design instruction, how we, you might call it epistemic design, how we can design things so as to promote epistemic reflection about ideals and processes and the aims that they follow. So I think that these kind of frameworks give us an idea about what we can tackle instructionally. So that would be one part of my answer to the question. Sarit, are you coming?
I can add, I think, something small. I mean, to relate to Frank's question about the philosophical input into the learning sciences, I think of it, a good example is the confusion that we have over who is the source of knowledge, because we're really imbued in this constructivist, social constructivist perspective, if you like, that the students are construct knowledge. And this has been for a long time part of really the understanding of dimensions of epistemic thinking has been along the dimension of whether the knowledge is constructed by the learner or is perceived as handed down from the teacher as a given, as a source of authority. And in recent years, we've had a lot of criticism of that idea coming from philosophical perspectives that say that, you know, sources of authority can be very good testimonial sources of knowledge. So I think that it's sort of like a very delicate point right now, but I think the field is still figuring out how to relate our instructional understandings and sensibilities to more philosophical considerations. And I think that both fields have to weigh in. And there's this great recent article, Educational Psychologist, by Keith Weber and Pablo Ramos, which discuss that problem in the area of mathematical proof. So I think those are two strands that are in flux right now. I mean, they're merging is creating new problems for us in the conceptualization of epistemic thinking, but it's also a very good advance and opening up new directions for consideration.
So I agree with what Sarit said, and I would add, I think that I think the amount of philosophy to read is manageable. If you look at, you know, there's a number of science educators who are well versed in philosophy, and they manage, you know, they have done that as productive science educators research, and you know, they clearly read, you know, many of the major works in science education. So I think that I don't think I view it as something that we should be doing. Obviously, we can't read as widely as a philosopher will do, but I think we can certainly read some of the major works in the fields. Yeah, so I agree with the UIC comments. So yes, I think looking at criteria and evidentiary reasoning, although it might be the case that, and I think that these notions of causal schemas for how we produce knowledge are an important part of evidentiary reasoning.
Okay, so I also think that this would be a good point to close this session. We're a bit over time. Clark, we thank you very much. That was a very interesting webinar. I'm still, considering the possible schema for this causal explanation, the schema that you showed on slide 20. And I have to think more deeply about that. I have to admit it. I think it's a good, for me, it's a great way to differentiate some of my more rough thoughts about that. So maybe we have a quick round through the different sites. Everyone say, final comment or bye-bye. And then you will have the final word, Clark, and then we close the session. So thanks again. That was fantastic.
So thanks also from the LMU side for sharing your view and your insights and elaborating on your article. As an organizational point, I'm just posting a link to a webinar evaluation form in the chat. It would be really great if all of you could fill out that evaluation form. It only takes 2 to 3 minutes. It's really short. Thank you and bye-bye. Have a nice evening, morning, or whatever. Bye-bye.
Well, let me, since nobody else is jumping in, this is my first time to do a webinar. I think I probably improved my causal schemas for how to do a good webinar. I really appreciate all the questions that folks have asked there. Now that the webinar, as we wrap up, I'll have more time to think about them. They were great questions that I'd like to think about more. And I hope that for all of us in this webinar, that those of us interested in epistemic cognition, this helps us identify colleagues we have around, and that we will be talking with each other in the future in conferences. I really hope that I'll have chances to talk with you, and I'm sure many of you would like that to get together with folks who have been here as well. So I really appreciate all your participation. I really appreciate the invitation to do this, and I really enjoyed thinking about these issues in preparation for it.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Clark.
Thank you, David, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, and I also wanted to say I'm looking forward to the workshop you're going to be doing at ICLS, and I just kind of wanted to mention that, I suppose, in case anybody else here was interested in it.
Yes, that's great. I probably was negligent in not doing some advertising for the ICL session, but the idea will take people's various frameworks for thinking about epistemic cognition and applying them to sort of, you know, rich interview or classroom discourse so that we can try to figure out how we can go about tackling analysis of discourse from an epistemic perspective.
Maybe use that opportunity for another announcement. Clark, you're also part of another symposium on domain specificity or domain generality of scientific reasoning and argumentation. There will also be a contribution by Dave Klar and by Jonathan Osborne and by Christoph Becker and Andrea Sedmanek, who is one of our PhD students sitting there. So it would be great to see some of you there as well.
Yeah, and although if you look at some of the slides I didn't get to, I think quite a few of them are self-explanatory, and you'll see the lines of argument. And a lot of those lines of arguments are domain specificity arguments. And so I'm looking forward, Frank, to talking with you more about these issues and with your group, because I know your group is doing a lot of research on this topic right now.